over to your place now, which will probably piss off your wife, or you can tell me over the phone.
The man coughed sleepily.
I'll meet you at the embassy. Give me an hour.
I don't have an hour.
Ivan cleared his throat, and then she heard him moving around. She assumed he was leaving his bedroom. Finally, he said,
This is an open line.
Zoya ignored the comment and said,
Just tell me who we can send to help me find someone along the border to the east of the city.
That's a little vague, isn't it?
I'm talking about a force, a persuasive force.
I thought you had a force.
Someone who knows the area, who won't stick out. A proxy unit. I don't care if we never use them, have no relationship to them. I don't care if they are communists, drug dealers, fucking headhunters, or cannibals. I don't care. I need them, and I need them now.
An open line, Sarina.
Help me.
Okay.
Ivan thought a moment.
What's in it for them?
The guy I'm looking for, he's valuable, very valuable. If they can find him, they can have him.
How does that help you? What the hell is going on?
This is an in extremis situation. I don't know the local underworld here in Cambodia, and neither do my guys, but you do. Right now, I know where my target is, generally speaking. But if someone doesn't go get him right now, then he's in the wind, and we may never pick him back up. I want him caught by a known entity so I can find him again.
This pause was even longer. Finally, the assistant resident said,
The group you are looking for, they aren't Cambodian. The guys you want are Thai. They are well connected in that part of the country, but we don't work with them. We don't touch them, ever.
I need a phone number.
Shit, Sarina, it's 3 a.m.
And by 4 it will be too late.
Okay, I'll send it to you.
They are based in Bangkok, but they smuggle over the border through Cambodia and into Vietnam all the time. The route they use is just east of the capital, the area you are talking about.
Perfect, Zoya said.
Hook me up with them, and then you can go back to bed.
I hope Moscow is okay with this.
Moscow is interested in success. That is what we will provide them.
Chapter 32. Court Gentry and Fan Xiong walked in the darkness for 5 hours, taking only short breaks when they found dry ground. The first portion of their hike, up to and including the border crossing into Cambodia, had been slow and arduous. A seemingly never-ending series of muddy fields and flooded rice paddies broken every 20 minutes or so by thick, nearly impenetrable tree lines full of thorny underbrush and ankle-twisting root systems. For the past hour and a half, however, they'd walked primarily along dirt or gravel roads as they continued to the west. They'd not seen another soul the entire time, which was good news for Court, because the batteries had gone dead in his night vision binos an hour earlier, and he'd buried the device under thatch and fallen leaves, and without it, he found it much harder to avoid dangers in their path. Court had dumped the rifle as well, although he felt sick about doing it. He knew there were a lot of threats in his path still. The Russians would have expected him to make a run into Cambodia, and the MI8 might come back looking for him. But he couldn't just walk public roads with a carbine on his shoulder, so he disassembled it and threw it into a grove of thick jungle along the way, and hoped like hell he wasn't going to regret the decision. Fan had been silent much of the way, other than occasional lamentations about his feet hurting and his legs cramping. Court had ignored him at first, then consented to his pleas for breaks every now and then. But now Court began to worry as the young man started limping noticeably. The American realized they wouldn't be able to make it much farther. They left a road when it turned to the north because Court wanted to keep going west towards the population center of Phnom Penh. He didn't have a map on him, but he'd studied the area knowing he might have to come this way, and he remembered the route in a general sense, so they followed a dark, narrow trail through rough jungle. He thought he was saving time doing this, getting Fan to the west where he knew the farmland ended and there were more villages and even small towns. But after 20 minutes, the dark wooded trail ended at a slow-moving river, with no way across anywhere he could see. Court's heart sank. It was easily 75 yards across, and while there was a tiny boat dock and a dilapidated wooden shack here, there were no boats at the dock, and no signs of life on either bank of the river. When he saw the water in the low light, Court remembered from the map that this river wound around the southeastern part of the nation, and this told him he was farther south than he'd thought. He also remembered there were no bridges for miles in either direction, and he didn't think Fawn would be able to walk nearly that far in his condition. Court turned to the young computer expert.
Let me guess, you can't swim.
Fawn replied defensively.
I can swim, but I am too tired. I will drown, I promise you.
Court nodded. He looked at the area around him and saw that the shack was missing part of its roof, but the broken concrete slab it was built upon was dry. The jungle and the riverbank looked like prime locations for snakes to hang out, so he told Fawn they'd take a break right here on the slab. Together they went into the shack and sat down on the hard concrete. Court knelt over Fawn and helped him get his shoes off, then used the small penlight feature on his thermal monocular, basically the only item to survive sliding down the levee, to look over Fawn's feet. They were blistered and bleeding, but only because they weren't calloused to begin with. With a little bandaging, Court decided Fawn would be fine. Court said,
Take off that hoodie. It's 80 degrees.
Fawn did as Court instructed, and Court ripped the hood off, then cut it into two strips. The material was damp, but not completely soaked, and Court tied them gently over Fawn's blisters. He said,
We can wait here until daylight, probably in another 45 minutes or so. If someone comes with the boat, we get a ride out of here, and we get a phone. If nobody comes by in the next 2 hours, then we swim across, and we keep going.
But I can't walk any farther.
Court said,
That's why we're resting, and that's why I'm bandaging your feet.
Fawn just nodded distractedly, then said,
This is crazy.
What's crazy? Court asked.
Everything. This night. That, back there. With the shooting. The soldiers. You. This is not my life. My life is 3 computer terminals and access to the networks of the Strategic Support Force.
Court said nothing. He just worked on making himself more comfortable. He had a good view up the trail, so if anyone came from that direction using flashlights, he'd see them long before they saw him. Fawn said,
But all this, everything that happened tonight, I guess this is what you do.
Court smiled a little, still looking up the trail.
What can I say? I'm not smart enough to be a computer hacker, so I get the shit work, like this.
Fawn gave out what sounded to the American to be a tired sob. Then said,
I don't know what I'm doing here.
Court scanned the trees around him now, doing his best to absorb any light. While doing so, he said,
Of course you do. You ran. They chased. If you hadn't jumped the border, we wouldn't be having so much fun right now.
I did not want to run. It happened so fast.
Court kicked his own shoes off. They wouldn't dry out, but letting the skin of his feet get some air around it would help them heal.
Seems like an odd thing to do on the spur of the moment. Come on, dude. When you escaped, I'm sure you knew the Chinese would come after you, and I'm sure you knew any of the countries you'd worked against would be interested in you, too.
You don't even know the work I did, do you?
Like I said, cyber warfare is a bit over my head.
Well, I did not work against the United States. That's another portion of my unit. My job was to find access points into my own nation's secure networks by using the tactics of 61398. There is a big difference.
Court said, Maybe to your conscience, not to your desirability. Look, I just came because I was sent. I don't care what you did or to who. I wouldn't even understand it if you told me.
Court lay down on the cement, facing Fan Xiang.
The only thing I am curious about is why you decided to make a break for it.
Fan did not respond for a long time. Court thought the kid wanted to say something, but had decided against it. Finally, the young man answered.
The security department kept watch on us at all times, but that was everyone in the unit. I worked with a team inside Unit 61398, called Red Cell. There were five of us. They had another way to keep us in line. There was an official term for it, but most everyone called it family collateral.
What's that?
Our relatives. Everyone on the team had a wife or a husband, children, other family members who were kept at the compound in Shanghai. Treated well, full party benefits, but watched over 24 hours a day by an escort, a member of the security unit.
So they kept your wife and kids inside the military installation?
I was married when I was 18. The department encouraged it. She was our lieutenant in the PLA, which made it easy for us to prove our loyalty to the party. But 6 years ago, she died. During childbirth.
Court looked up to the lightening sky. Sorry.
Yes. I was going to have a son.
Damn. Neither spoke for a full minute. Court was exhausted and he didn't know what this day would bring. He imagined he still had many miles to go before he'd find a way to pass Fawn off to U.S. authorities. But Fawn wanted to talk.
When she died, when they died, I mean, security at 61398 brought my parents into the compound in Shanghai from their home in Beijing. Family collateral. My parents were my only relatives. I was told if I remarried, they could return to Beijing. But I did not want to remarry so soon.
Court just said, that must have been tough on your parents.
It was the opposite. My father was a colonel in the PLA, and my mother had been a mathematician at the National Defense University. They were proud to support the work I did by living in the compound. They were assigned a guardian, Major Song Julong. He was charged with watching over them, and he had served under my father, so it was good for everyone. Me, my parents, and Song.
Court rolled up onto his arm now and looked at Fawn. He understood for the first time in this mission what had started this entire situation. But something happened, didn't it? Something that forced you to run. Fawn looked back to the American in the low light and nodded slowly.
Yes, something happened.
2 weeks earlier, Shenzhen, People's Republic of China. Fan Xiong moved briskly, swinging his briefcase along with his stride, his tie loose and his parted hair hanging low and boyishly after a full day walking the exhibition floors of the China Information Technology Expo. The massive event was winding down for the evening. Thousands of men and women filed out of doors, down escalators. They flagged cabs and stepped onto metro cars and buses. Fan was right along with the crowd, fitting in as an unremarkable young businessman, although one flanked by two much larger and much less talkative co-workers. Fan was tired. Most every day of his life involved 12 to 14 hours sitting at a desk, so just participating in a trade show was real physical work to him. He was looking forward to getting back to his room so he could pig out on room service, then go to bed early. Tomorrow, he and his guards would fly back to Shanghai, and by mid-afternoon, he would be back in his uniform and back at his desk. And as novel as it was to come here to get intelligence on the work done by IT corporations around the world, he was ready to return to his normal and sedentary existence. His bodyguards, Chen and Leo, were arguably more exhausted than their protectee, because while Fan had to talk to dozens of people and take pages of notes, the two security officers had to stay ultra-vigilant at all times. Tough to do, considering the fact that the expo was a massive transitional space, with thousands of people moving around. The three men pushed through the revolving doors of the expo's lobby and out into the 6 p.m. heat, heading to the cab stand to catch a taxi back to the Sheraton. Before they made their way to the back of the long line, Sergeant Chen's cell phone trilled in the breast pocket of his gray suit coat. He pulled it out, looked down to the phone to identify the call, then held it out to his protectee without answering it.
Fan, it's your mother. We'll get in line. You sit on that bench right there by the door. Xiexie.
Thank you, Fan said as he took the phone. Fan liked to be separated from the two agents while he spoke to his parents. Not because he had anything to hide. Rather, he was embarrassed to talk to his mother in earshot of the tough bodyguard. As he sat on the bench, he said,
Ni hao, mama.
The voice on the other end of the line was not his mother. It was a male voice, but it was not his father. Fan Xian recognized the voice of his parents' government-issued escort, Major Song Julong.
Zhang, it's me. It's Julong.
Fan knew the man well. He'd become part of the family in the past 6 years since his parents were brought into the unit and moved to the compound in Shanghai. Song was with them virtually all the time, and Fan spent most of his free time at his parents' apartment, just a few buildings away from his own. When he did this, it was common for Song Julong to join them for dinner, watch television with them, or play games. He'd become something of an adopted brother to Fan. Fan said,
Ni hao, Song. Why are you calling for my mother's phone?
The man spoke quickly.
Something terrible has happened.
Fan sat up quickly.
What's happened?
Song's voice was serious, ominous.
You cannot react to what I am telling you. I did not call you. This is your mother calling. Do you understand me?
Fan did not understand, but the man's tone made him nervous.
Put her on the phone, or my father. They are both with you? When the security department finds out, you know what they will do. Finds out what? What are you talking about?
Song said,
Softly, Jiang. If Chen and Leo are there, do not let them hear you.
Fan glanced up at the men in the taxi line. They were lighting cigarettes and talking to each other, not even looking his way.
They can't hear me. Tell me what is happening. Fan, there has been an accident just now. Not 5 minutes ago. Accident? Are my parents? I was driving. It was me. A sand truck from the construction site on the inner ring elevated road backed up just as I was passing. No! Please tell me they are okay, Julong. Keep your voice down. You understand what this means for you, don't you? For me? Where are my parents?
Song shouted into the phone now.
They are dead, Jiang. They are both dead, killed instantly. I am sorry. I am so, so sorry, but you can't react to what I am telling you.
Fan leaned forward suddenly, as if he'd been punched in the stomach. Song said,
Your parents were good people. They were like my own parents, who I lost when I was young. You know that. You know I didn't want this.
Fan just stared at the sidewalk in front of the taxi stand now, still in a state of shock. He tried to clear his head and think.
I'll tell the guys. They will get us on a flight tonight. I'll be home as soon as I can. No, said Song. You don't get it. You still don't get what I am trying to tell you, do you? I am calling you now, before anyone in 61398 finds out, because of your participation in Red Cell. 10 minutes ago, you had the highest security clearance in the nation. Now, when the police get here, and when MSS and MOD find out the identity of the dead, you will have no clearance. You will have all the secrets of the Strategic Support Force in your head, but you will be deemed untrustworthy by the government. You have no more family collateral, and when 61398 finds out, it will be all over for you.
Fan just looked at his two bodyguards. They were making their way closer to the front of the taxi line. Chen glanced his way and tapped his finger on his watch. Fan nodded, then turned away.
How much time do I have? You are in Shenzhen. We are in Shanghai. The car is burning. They won't find their IDs. I walked away from the accident. I'll tell them I hit my head and I didn't know what happened. Why? What are you talking about? You have 10, maybe 12 hours. By dawn tomorrow, MSS will be in contact with MOD and they will call Chen and Leo. MOD will order them to bring you straight into the security office of 61398. At that time, they will take your credentials and they will hold you. They will say it is for your own protection because of your grief, but they will keep you for a day or two while the orders are signed.
Fan asked the next part with a lump in his throat.
Orders? And then, the security director himself, Colonel Li, or else his second in command, Lieutenant Colonel Dai, will order you shot. That's how it happens. That's how they removed the compromise to Red Cell.
Phan knew nothing of this. He found it so hard to believe. But Song had worked as a security escort for a dozen years. They were friends. There was no reason he'd say any of this if it weren't true. Phan had seen two other men leave Red Cell when they lost family collateral. He'd been told they'd moved to other sectors. Now he wondered if they'd been executed. He just said,
I served faithfully. I have done all that was asked.
Song sniffed. Phan could almost hear the tears running down the man's face.
They only believed in you because they controlled you. That control is gone.
Song sniffed again.
You have to act tonight.
Phan shouted into the phone, loud enough that his two bodyguards looked towards him in surprise.
And do what?
Song said.
You need to run.
Phan turned away from Chen and Leo.
That's crazy. I have no idea how to do that.
It's okay, Xiang. I will tell you what to do. I will tell you what has worked in the past with defectors. Don't say it. Just listen to me very carefully.
But what about you? I'll be fine.
Phan heard a slur in Song's speech now. Maybe it had been there the entire time.
Why are you doing this for me?
I owe it to your parents.
Song tried to hide his drinking, but sometimes he showed up at Phan's parents' apartment drunk. Phan wondered if Song had been drinking today, if the story about the sand truck was not the complete story. But he did not press. He just listened. 5 minutes later, Phan handed the phone back to Sergeant Chen without saying a word. Chen was with Leo near the front of the taxi line and still thinking about the outburst he'd overheard.
Problems with your mommy, Phan? Did she buy you the wrong color underpants?
Leo laughed next to him. Phan just said,
No problems.
And then,
Guys, I feel a head cold coming on. I've had to shake too many dirty hands this week.
Leo nodded.
We all have. Disgusting guelo, mostly.
Can we go to a market and get some cold medicine? Something that will help me sleep?
It was a reasonable request, so Chen just shrugged.
There is a market around the corner from the Sheraton. We'll go there.
Washa,
Phan said. Perfect. Present day, Cambodia. Court looked at the little man lying on the cement foundation by the riverbank, and he could hardly believe he'd had the guts to sneak across the border into Hong Kong while being pursued by the full military and intelligence apparatus of the People's Republic of China. That said, he understood the young sergeant had absolutely no choice at all. He asked,
Did you ever find out what happened to Song?
Phan nodded. The morning light had grown to where it was now possible for Court to see the pain and the fatigue on Phan Chiang's face.
I looked on the internet when I was in Hong Kong. There was a single car crash in Shanghai on the Inner Ring Elevated Road at the same time as Song's call. I looked at the video from the news report. It was the car Song drove. Burning. It took an off-ramp too quickly and flipped. There was no construction site anywhere around. No sand truck involved either.
He was drunk.
Phan nodded.
And the guilt of killing my parents caused him to try to save me. The report said there were three victims of the crash.
Court blew out a long sigh now.
They terminated him.
Phan nodded, then concentrated on the American in front of him.
So, I told you all this. Now you must tell me the truth.
Depends on the question.
What is going to happen to me?
Don't worry. You're safe. First, I get you away from Colonel Dai and his men.
And then?
And then I am to hand you over to some nice people who'd like a word with you.
Phan sat up.
Where?
I don't know.
You are going to take me to the U.S. I know you are. I want to go to Taiwan.
Court didn't know why the kid wanted to go to Taiwan, and he didn't ask. He said,
The U.S. has good relations with Taiwan. I'm sure we'll work something out.
You are lying. The CIA is going to demand I work for them. They will hold me for years, force me to work against my home country. And if I refuse, will they send you to kill me?
Court chuckled.
It's the USA, not China. You might eat fatty food that gives you a heart attack and watch shitty TV that makes you want to kill yourself, but the CIA won't whack you.
Fan Xiang said,
I took nothing out of China when I left. No documents, no plans, no schematics for programs. I have nothing to turn over to anyone. I just want to go to Taiwan. Of course, I know I will be debriefed, but I refuse to work against the People's Republic of China.
Court thought this kid was about to cry, but as far as he was concerned, Fan Xiang was hopelessly naive. Fan said,
I am from China. I am not against China. Not even after what happened. I am for Fan Xiang. Can't I just leave this all behind?
I seriously doubt it, Court said to himself. Then he sighed a little. I'll talk to some people when we get out of here.
It was bullshit, and Court got the distinct impression Fan saw through it, because he sprang to his bare feet and took off for the dirt trail through the jungle. Court reached for him but missed, then put his own shoes on and chased after him. The faint morning light kept Fan from running off the trail and into a low-hanging branch, but Court caught up with him in under a minute, grabbing him by his shirt and tackling him to the ground. The bigger American put a knee in the young Chinese man's chest.
Calm down, kid. It's not so bad. We're the good guys.
Fan Xiang struggled.
No, you're not.
Court realized he was crushing the kid while telling him he was a good guy. He pulled his knee back.
Well, we're the better guys. Dai will kill you for what you did. Those Vietnamese back there will kill you for causing that massacre. And if the Russians got hold of you...
Court let that hang in the air for a moment. Fan said,
I want to go to Taiwan.
Right, Taiwan. Look, I'm going to hand you off to someone, and you can tell them that.
Court pulled Fan to his feet.
You've had a lot of bad luck, and I really wish you all the best, but I have a job to do. And I promise you, if you run from me again, you will just make your bad luck even worse, because I will kick your ass. We're finished waiting around here. If you can run like that, you can damn well cross that river. I'll be there right with you. I'll keep you safe.
Fan started to protest, but Court took him by the arm and began walking him back down to the water.
Come on, kid. Let's go for a swim.
The light was even better when they returned to the little shack by the beach, but as soon as the two men had a view down to the little docking area, they both stopped in their tracks. Three green power boats, each some 20 feet in length, floated silently in the water just yards offshore. And in them, some 2 dozen men, all armed with assault rifles and machetes, stared right back at Court and Fan with hard eyes. Over 12 muzzles pointed at the chests of the 2 foreigners.
Well, that's not good,
Court muttered.
Who are these men?
Fan whispered. Court sized up the men on the boats. They were sinewy, weathered, tan from living on the water and out in the elements. These guys knew the jungle.
The kind of men you don't piss off. Raise your hands slowly.
Shall we run?
Fan asked. Court raised his hands and Fan followed suit. Yes, Court could have run. He could have dived off the trail, rolled down into a shallow ditch in the trees and disappeared into the jungle. But not with Fan. Court said,
No, kid. We're going to do exactly what they say.
Where will they take us?
Just a guess. Not to Taiwan.
Chapter 33 The power boats were old and covered with rust and peeling paint, but each vessel had 2 huge and well-maintained engines, and the boats were each large enough to carry 8 men. Half of the men waded ashore, their weapons pointed right at Fan and Court, and then one of the boats pulled up to the rotting wooden dock. While the other vessels just trolled in the river, the gunmen on board training their Kalashnikovs on the pair of new captives. One of the men seemed to be in charge, simply because he began ordering the others around. He was of average size and build, and he appeared to be no older than 25 or so. He had a folded stock AK-47 hanging off his shoulder and a simple assault vest on his chest, and he wore a red bandana that held back his long, dark hair. His arms were covered in tats, like the others, and also like the others, his skin was burnt orange and leathery. His sunglasses and his wristwatch looked expensive to Court, but his gun and his gear looked third-rate. Red Bandana looked carefully at Fan Xiang, even stepping up to him, pinching his face in his hand, and moving his head around, examining the Chinese man as if he were looking at a horse at auction. He appeared to be making sure he had the right guy. With a nod to the armed men around him, he reached into one of the magazine pouches in his vest, then pulled out a plastic Ziploc bag. He opened it up and retrieved a mobile phone. While he dialed a number, he waved his free hand and shouted orders at the men standing around the two captives, and they all began moving. Court's wrists were pulled behind his back and tied with a length of thick hemp, and the man who did it was clearly an expert at the task. Even though Court knew he couldn't undo his hands, Court was glad he was being bound, because he figured he was just the booby prize for these guys. Fawn was the real catch. Being tied up meant Court was going for a ride, and he found that much preferable to getting shot and left in the jungle for the bugs. Court didn't imagine for a second this had been some sort of opportunistic kidnapping by river bandits who just happened by. So Court was glad that whoever was running the show on the other end of the phone didn't order them to just shoot the big American and be done with it. Court asked them who they were and what they wanted, and although none of them seemed to speak any English, after a nod from Red Bandana, a large man wearing an assault vest adorned with a huge Rambo combat knife in a sheath came over and smacked Court in the side of the head with the butt of his rifle. Court understood this language. Loosely translated, it meant, no more questions. Fan Xiang and Court Gentry were placed into the powerboat at the dock, and several gunmen climbed in with them. The prisoners were pushed down onto a bench in the middle of the boat, shoulder to shoulder, and while the commander continued his phone call on the bank, Fan leaned over and spoke into Court's ear. He said,
"They are Thai."
"How do you know?"
"I did some research on different organizations in Southeast Asia when I was in Hong Kong. The tattoos mean they are from a Thai Chow."
"What's that?"
"It just means they are an underworld group from Bangkok. There are lots of different organizations, but the biggest and most dangerous is called Shamroon Syndicate. They are all over, even in Hong Kong."
"Why didn't you work for them in Hong Kong?"
Fan just looked down at the deck of the boat. Softly, he said,
"Because they are animals. Vicious animals. Very bad."
"Terrific," Court muttered.
Soon Red Bandana boarded the same boat and sat down behind the man at the helm, and then the big outboard engines roared to life. 5 minutes later, all three boats raced single file south on the river, as the morning sun glared orange off the water. Court and Fan were seated among 8 men, most of whom sat on the gunwales on the port and starboard sides and held their rifles out, as if there were real threats here on this river. Court imagined there probably were, but he didn't think he could possibly be in deeper trouble than right here, in the middle of this boat. Court looked at Red Bandana now. He sat on the bench facing inboard. He had a cigarette in one hand and the mobile phone in the other, and his elbows were back on the portside gunwale behind him. He leaned back, relaxed and happy, after making this catch so early in his day. He hung up the phone a minute later and slid it back in the plastic bag, but instead of putting it back in his vest, he just tucked the phone under his leg on the bench. Court figured the phone was left out because Red Bandana was expecting another call. Court eyed the man on his right, just past Fan. He was taller than the others, and his big Rambo knife stuck straight up from its sheath on the front of his assault vest. His rifle faced outboard, but he looked Court's way through cheap aviator sunglasses. Scanning around the boat a little more, Court saw a space between 2 men sitting on the gunwale. It was on the starboard side, across from Red Bandana. The men looked out at the riverbank, with about 3 feet between them. Court took everything in again. The cell phone in the plastic bag sticking out from under the right leg of the man ahead and on his left. The knife on the man's chest rig on Court's right. And the clear space over the side of the boat, ahead and on Court's right. Court gazed out of the boat now, across the brown water. On the starboard side, the riverbank was only about 50 feet away. On the port side, however, it was a good 40 or 50 yards to the shore. Court imagined there was some rocks or other obstacles in the river ahead that caused the pilot to hug the western bank. One more quick scan around him, and Court made his decision. He leaned over to Fan and whispered,
"Do everything they say. Don't put yourself in danger. Sooner or later, probably sooner, they'll sit you down in front of a computer to do some work for them. When that happens, figure out a way to let America know where you are."
Fan shook his head now,
I'm not letting America know anything. The Taiwanese will save me. I just have to tell them where I am.
Kid, you aren't getting saved by Taiwan. They don't even know you are on the run.
Fan turned to Court.
Yes, they do. They promised me a new life, a house, a job.
Court was confused. When was this?
Right before they helped me get out of the mainland.
What the hell are you talking about?
That's how I got away. Song told me to go to the Lo Wu border crossing and wait. I did this, and a man stepped up to me. He was from Taiwan. He gave me papers to cross into Hong Kong. He said I would be met on the other side and taken to Taipei. But when I crossed over, there was no one there. I realized I was followed over the border, so I ran.
None of this made a bit of sense to Court. If Taiwanese intelligence had spirited Fan out of the mainland, why wasn't Court told about it? Taipei had a good working relationship with the CIA. There was no way CIA would not know of Taiwan's involvement in Fan's escape from the mainland. Court said,
The papers you mentioned, they had your picture? They were already prepared?
Yes.
So, Song must have contacted Taiwan on your behalf before he was killed? He was a double agent?
Fan cocked his head a little, thinking about it.
No, Song was no Taiwan agent. The man at the border crossing said they had intercepted the phone call between Song and me and prepared everything. Then they just waited for me to arrive.
Bullshit, thought Court.
If Song told Fan to go to that particular border crossing and wait, then Song set up Fan's escape with Taiwanese intelligence. Court saw no way that the CIA could be unaware of this, but he didn't know why the hell Taiwan helped Fan get out of the mainland, only to leave him high and dry in Hong Kong. Something very wrong must have happened with the operation. Slowly, it dawned on him. Court had been told that the CIA got involved with this when they found out Fan was being hunted by Fitzroy, thereby creating a perfect opportunity to send in one of Fitzroy's old hitmen in order to nab Fan. But that story was a lie. No. This whole thing was some kind of a busted op. Something involving Taiwan and the United States, perhaps, and CIA had sent Court in to help salvage it. Court leaned back to Fan.
Wo Xing Wo, how did you get hooked up with them?
Desperation. I was walking the streets of Hong Kong for a day, afraid to even go to a hotel with the papers I had been given. I slept in an alley. Finally, I went to an internet cafe and called a number I found for the National Security Bureau, Taiwan's intelligence agency, but it was just some operator. I was put on hold. I got scared and left the cafe, but just after I left, I saw men with guns racing.
Court mumbled.
Colonel's Dai men were already in Hong Kong looking for you.
I went to another cafe and began looking for protection in Hong Kong. I knew I could work for some group, help them out, but I needed to be someone who wasn't afraid of mainland security.
Court had to admit Fan's plan had been solid and effective. He had surrounded himself with guns and a defensive infrastructure, and that got him out of Hong Kong and kept him from getting assassinated by Colonel Dai's men. But now, looking around at the wild river bandits surrounding them on the boat, Court thought Fan's run of relative fortune might have run out. He said,
I'll find out what's going on. Don't do anything stupid, but find a way to reach out to us, and I'll come back for you. I promise.
Fan looked away and shook his head.
What are you talking about? You are in the same situation as me. You can't get away from these men.
Yeah, you're probably right.
Court leaned over on the bench and looked down at the deck for several seconds, his head almost between his knees. He was the picture of compliance. Not one of the eight men around him expected any movement out of him whatsoever. While he looked like a man dejected, he was in fact already hard at work on his play. He slowly, quietly sucked in deep lungfuls of air, then blew them out through his mouth, careful to make no sound with either the inhalations or the exhalations. In and out, he breathed so deep it hurt his chest, hurt the raw scar from his month-old gunshot wound to his ribs, over and over. The entire time he'd been perfectly still, but now he looked up and around, slowly, calmly, still hiding his deep breaths. The positioning of all the important elements on the boat were exactly the same, and the rugged jungle terrain on the far bank looked identical here to the way it had during the entire time he'd been on the speedboat. One more massive breath. He felt he'd stretched his lungs to capacity over the past minute, and one more long, slow exhalation. And then he did it. His right foot slid out in front of him. He swiveled his hips to his right, his butt left the seat, and he spun around 90 degrees and took one squatted step backwards across the tiny deck. His bound hands reached out behind him, and he grabbed the hilt of the big knife on the man's chest rig before the man even turned his head towards the movement. Court launched forward in the direction of Red Bandana, drawing the knife from the sheath behind his back as he moved. And as he flew across the width of the speedboat, he sucked in the biggest lungful of air he'd taken in his entire life. He landed on his knees next to Red Bandana, still sucking in, but as part of the movement of propelling himself forward, his head came down, and he held in his air and bit into the plastic bag holding the cell phone, right next to Red Bandana's leg. The leader of the group shouted out, but he only pulled his leg away in an automatic reaction to the movement. By now, most everyone on board was shouting. Some had begun swiveling their weapons inward to the blurring motion in their midst, and a small man at the stern launched himself up and started moving past Fawn and towards the big American. Court thrust his body up, going from his knees to his feet, and then he launched himself into a backflip off the boat, right through the open space between two men sitting on the starboard side gunwale. As he flew through the air, he caught a last glimpse of Fan Xiang, still sitting on the bench, his eyes wide with astonishment. Court crashed through the surface of the muddy river and disappeared below. The men on the boat were standing now, rifles swinging in all directions. The man at the helm realized his captive had gone overboard, so he reduced the throttle and turned hard to starboard, in the direction the man had leapt. The other power boats approached the area. Red Bandana stood and screamed, and men on all three watercraft began firing their rifles at the place where the big American disappeared. Below the brown surface, the first thing Court did, before he began cutting with the knife, was to reverse his direction. Everyone had seen him backflip off the boat towards the nearest shore, and it made more sense he would head that way, because of both its proximity and the fact that he and Fawn had been heading west when they'd been caught. So by swimming back under the wake of the speedboat and kicking back to the east, he knew he'd caused most everyone on the boats to look in the wrong direction. Once he'd put 20 or 30 yards between himself and the spot in the river where he went under, he continued swimming, but slower now, while he carefully turned the sharp knife around with the fingers of his bound hands. He knew dropping the knife would probably mean he'd either get shot or drown, because without the use of his hands, there was no way he'd be able to swim far enough away from the boats before surfacing to where he would not be seen. He began cutting, concentrating on working as efficiently as possible, and also on keeping his teeth clenched on the plastic bag in his mouth. Court could hold his breath for 3.5 minutes without any trouble, but not when he was exerting himself like this. He figured he'd have to surface in less than 1.5 minutes, so he kept kicking while he worked, knowing every single yard he traveled would reduce the risk he'd be spotted when he finally did come up for air. At the 1 minute mark, he still had a lot of cutting to do, but he kept sawing, kept kicking, kept holding his breath. His lungs screamed, and he felt the muscles in his legs and hands hurt from the lack of fresh oxygen, but he just kicked harder, sawed faster, told himself his body could shake off the effects of another 30 seconds of oxygen deprivation so much better than it could shake off the effects of an AK-47 burst to the back of his head. When he'd finally cut all the rope away, he slid the knife into his waistband at the small of his back, then took the bag with the phone in it out of his mouth and shoved it down the front of his pants, and now he began exhaling as he swam furiously, his mind dulling, his sense of direction beginning to fail him. He surfaced slowly and silently 40 yards away from where he went under, but the speedboats had moved closer to the western shoreline, so he was even farther from the men looking for him. He took in a quick 3-second breath and then slipped back under the brown surface, feeling the ecstasy of oxygen in his exhausted body. He made it another minute before surfacing once more, and soon he was 80 yards from the boats and in the thick river grasses. By the time he looked back around, the speedboats were turning back up to the south and continuing on their voyage. They had their main prize, so they'd press on. Court couldn't see Fan Xiang, but he knew he was still with the river pirates, and he knew the young man must have felt like he'd been abandoned by the man who told him he'd keep him safe. And Fan Xiang was absolutely right about that. Court crawled up into the jungle, waterlogged and exhausted, his muscles and his mind spent. He pulled the knife out of his pants and stabbed it into the ground next to him before he took out the phone. After turning it on and figuring out how to use the old simple device, he tapped in Suzanne Brewer's phone number. He sucked a few tired breaths, then looked down at the tiny screen. No signal. He sighed, then dropped the back of his head into the mud.
Well, that fucking figures.
Court rolled over onto his knees, grabbed the knife, then half-crawled and half-staggered into the woods. 90 minutes later, he found a clearing at the edge of a sweet potato farm from where he could see a well-traveled highway in the distance. He sat down behind a large palm tree at the edge of the clearing, pulled out the phone, and tried it again. It took 40 seconds before he heard the phone ring on the other end. He breathed a fresh sigh of relief when the call was answered on the second ring.
Brewer.
Hi, Mom.
1 second.
Court sat there a moment, either while Suzanne Brewer tried to figure out how to proceed with the challenge response protocol, or while she recovered from being called Mom by an agent roughly her age.
Hi, son. So nice to hear from you. I was just watching your favorite documentary about Venus.
This was his challenge code, delivered oddly but effectively. Court just replied,
"The one about Vesuvius is even better."
His response was delivered in the same cryptic form as the challenge because of the open line.
"Right,"
Brewer said, confirming his response.
"What's this number you're calling from? Are you in?"
Court said.
"Yep, afraid so. I borrowed it from a friend."
"I see. Are you somewhere safe?"
"Actually, I was hoping you could tell me where I am."
Brewer's voice displayed incredulity.
"You don't know where you are?"
"Long night. You know how it is."
"Right. I can do that. Wait just a second."
Court's reply dripped with sarcasm.
"Nothing but time on my end, Mom."
Suzanne Brewer had been lying on her back on her sofa in her office when the call came through, and it had been some struggle to get back up onto her knee scooter and over to her desk to grab it. She saw from her computer that the call was coming from a Cambodian cell phone carrier, and her agent was telling her he didn't know where the hell he was, which was confusing to her, but she knew what she had to do. She pressed a button on her desk that went to the operations center. A tired voice came over the phone seconds later.
"Opscom,
I need you to geolocate the origin of the call I'm on right now. How long to do that?"
"Landline or cell phone?"
"Cell, out of Cambodia."
40 seconds for the tower, another minute to a minute and a half for the GPS coordinates."
"Go."
"On it."
Suzanne hung up from the operations communications, then went back to the line from Cambodia. She said,
"I'm working on getting you fixed up."
Violator would know that by fix, she meant they were ascertaining his location.
"What else can you tell me about your vacation?"
"I'm hoping you can help me catch a ride right now, to get me out of here. I was traveling with a friend, but we got separated, so it's just me."
"Who was the friend?"
"The one you told me not to meet up with on my own."
Brewer kept her voice flat, knowing this was an open line.
"Well, we can talk more about that later. I'm just glad you are safe, son."
That wasn't true. Violator would know it, but Brewer didn't care.
"Are you okay?"
"I'm fine, considering how hard we partied last night."
Brewer closed her eyes in frustration.
"I'm disappointed in you, son."
"I know, Mom. I'm your wild child."
"Your friends from Hong Kong, did they come with you?"
"No, but I'm sure they are wondering what's happened to me."
Just then, an instant message popped up on her computer screen. She opened it and saw it was from Opscom. A satellite map of Cambodia was attached, and she clicked on it, enlarged it, and enlarged it again. A small red star showed her the position of the cell phone in Violator's hand, down to an exactitude of less than 5 feet.
"How the hell did you get there?"
"I've got stories for the slideshow when I get home."
And then he said,
"And I also have some serious questions for you and Dad. I'm looking forward to a long conversation the next time we talk."
Brewer blew out a sigh, still looking at the blip in a clearing by a field alongside a winding brown river in the wilds of Cambodia. She knew what Violator was telling her, and she knew it wasn't good.
"Let me get to work here. Try to find some way out of there for you."
Violator replied,
"I know where my friend is going. I'm heading there next.
Brewer shook her head, but she let on none of her disapproval. She just said,
One thing at a time, son. I'll send someone to pick you up. Not sure when it will be, so just sit tight.
It's that or start working on a dugout canoe.
I'll get you home, Tom.
Tom? Cort would realize that he needed to remember the name she just gave him. He started to say something else, but Brewer hung up. She wasn't one to chat. She had to work on his extraction, and she had to figure out just what to tell him about CIA's involvement in the operation to extract Fan Xiang from China. Chapter 34 The helicopter was nothing but a tiny insect when he first noticed it, a speck of black hanging just over the endless green delta to the south. It seemed to flicker in the morning haze, still miles away. It grew quickly, though, and Cort caught himself hoping it would develop into the shape of a Huey. He had an affinity for the old helicopters. His dad had flown around in them in Vietnam, and Cort himself trained in them almost exclusively with the CIA's Autonomous Asset Development Program, simply because they were smaller and cheaper to operate than the Black Hawks that all but replaced them, and since he trained alone and the U.S. government still had lots of old Hueys at their disposal, that had been his principal ride. And now that he was here in Southeast Asia, looking to the sky for a savior, he thought it would be appropriate to have a Huey sweep in and pick him up. He got his wish. Cort recognized the UH-1Y, called the Yankee, though everyone in the U.S. military referred to it as a skid if it carried a weapon, or a slick if it was unarmed. He'd expected the aircraft to be unmarked. Back when he was in the CIA as a paramilitary operations officer, he sometimes worked with members of the military. But they were always blackside types, Delta Force, SEAL Team 6, Special Operations, Communications, and Electronic Intelligence personnel, or deep cover spooks from the Defense Intelligence Agency. He never flew on a marked military aircraft. But as the Huey got closer, Cort saw the unmistakable markings of the United States Marine Corps, and as the aircraft hovered over the LZ, he saw it was a skid. A crew chief sat in the open door with a big 50-caliber machine gun poking out of the side. It occurred to him that this meant the U.S. Marine Corps was conducting an armed invasion into Cambodia on his behalf.
Awkward, Cort thought.
How did Brewer manage this? The Huey touched down on the grass of the clearing next to the sweet potato field. By now, a few locals stood on a nearby levee and looked on. Cort hoped these farmers didn't have a cell phone on them, but he had bigger things to worry about. He ran under the spinning rotors and climbed aboard. The crew chief directed him to a bench along the bulkhead, strapped him in as if Cort had never ridden in a helicopter in his life, and then put a headset microphone on Cort's head. The crew chief wore the rank of corporal on his flight suit, under the big flight helmet and the blacked-out visor and the microphone covering his face. Cort figured the Marine was no more than 21 years old. Still, Cort let the kid run the show. This was his aircraft, and the filthy, unshaved American hanging out in the flatlands of Cambodia was just a passenger. The young man spoke into his mic, and it came through Cort's earphones. He could hear the excitement in the Marine's voice about conducting such an odd operation.
Sir, can I have your name, please?
Cort followed the instructions given to him by Brewer just 3 hours earlier.
I'm Tom.
Then we're your chariot, sir. We'll get you out of here and take you wherever you want to go, he added. As long as we have the fuel.
The crew chief clearly knew nothing about what was going on, other than his aircraft's orders to get to a particular grid and pick up a man named Tom, then to follow the man's subsequent orders.
What are my options? Cort asked.
The aircraft took off immediately, rising straight up into the sky.
We've got fuel to get you to Phnom Penh or Saigon. Which do you prefer?
How did you work that out with the governments of Cambodia and Vietnam?
The crew chief stared back at Cort. He looked like a big insect with his black visor covering his eyes.
No idea, sir. I think something is arranged. We were told we could go wherever, but that's a little bit above my pay grade.
Cort just nodded. He wondered if CIA had asked permission for this flight or if they were going to just ask forgiveness after the fact. He decided it was above his pay grade as well, so he didn't stress about it.
Cort asked, Did you guys come off a ship?
A nod from the big helmet.
Yes, sir. We're on the Boxer. It's at LHD. That's an assault ship. We're just leaving exercises in the South China Sea.
And where are you heading?
The kid couldn't hide a little grin.
Bangkok, 48 hours liberty.
Court nodded thoughtfully, looking down at the sweet potato farm rolling away below.
You think the Navy would mind giving me a ride?
Don't see why not, sir. They give us Marines a ride, and we can be a handful. I doubt you'd be much trouble at all.
Court nodded.
Bangkok works for me.
Roger that, sir.
The crew chief switched channels on his radio and told the pilot to return to the ship. Back on Court's channel, he said,
About 50 mics flying time. Make yourself comfortable. You look like you could do with some chow.
You buying?
Sure am.
The corporal handed Court a huge bottle of water and an MRE. Court drank half the bottle without stopping, then looked at the bag holding the prepackaged meal. Chicken stew. Court smiled, took a knife from the crew chief, cut the package open, and began wolfing it down cold. The crew chief split his time between looking out the open door, close enough to the 50 cal to where he could slide over and operate it if trouble arose, and trying to steal glances at the man sitting across from him. Court let it go for a minute, then looked up at the young man and shook his head once. The crew chief turned away and focused his attention completely on the river and jungle racing by below. Court's mind went back to his mission. He'd been forced to leave Fon with the Thai River pilots because there was no way he was getting the young man off that boat without both of them getting killed. It had been a hard choice to make, but Fon himself had given him a lead as to what group had kidnapped him. A Thai criminal organization had Fon now, and it was up to Brewer and Colonel Dai, each working alone, to figure out exactly where they would take Fon Chiang. Court had gone nearly 24 hours without checking in with Dai. He'd have to call him after he got settled on the Boxer, so for now, he just rode in the back of the skid and tried to work on some story that Dai would believe. He knew he'd have to spin one hell of an epic tale of bullshit to keep Dai from putting a bullet in Don Fitzroy's head. And speaking of tales of epic bullshit, there was Suzanne Brewer. He would call her first, and he would find out what the fuck was really going on. There was more to this mission than he understood, and he worried he wasn't going to like what he found out about it. Suzanne Brewer had spent the evening hours moving mountains to arrange for an agent to be picked up in the wilds of Southeast Asia and ferried out to a passing U.S. Navy vessel. When everything was settled, she'd laid down on the sofa in her office, elevated her leg to reduce the lingering pain in the weeks-old injury, and fallen quickly asleep. The trilling of the phone on her desk woke her at 4 a.m., sending her rocking up slowly, where she grabbed her crutches, not bothering with her knee scooter to get across the room. 10 minutes later, she was halfway through Violator's after-action report of the events near the Cambodian border and the evening before. He was on the USS Boxer in a secluded area and able to talk unrestricted over the secure line. He told his story chronologically. He seemed to include all the important details, and Brewer took notes on a pad while he spoke. She wanted him to jump ahead to tell her what the hell happened to Fon Chiang, but she knew better than to interrupt his train of thought as long as he was providing relevant information. But when he said, matter-of-factly,
I feel sure the attacking paramilitary force was Russian,
she interrupted, because this was an especially important development.
How do you know that?
I've seen Russian special operations forces in the field before. GRU Spetsnaz, FSB Spetsnaz, and SVR Zaslan. This looked like the way they did things. I can't really say why, but I'm sure they were Russian. It wouldn't make sense for the GRU to be involved because this isn't a military operation, and FSB mostly works closer to Russia's borders. I'm guessing this was a Zaslan team.
That's pretty thin, Brewer chastised.
Yes, Gentry admitted. Unless you put some credence into the intuition of a guy who's been working in this field for 20 years.
Fair enough.
Oh, and there was a woman with them.
A woman?
In an operational role. She wasn't stacking up with the Zaslan guys, but she breached the target location alone at the same time they did. Brewer spoke with authority.
Zaslan doesn't have females. None of the Spetsnaz groups do.
I'm just telling you what I saw. My guess is she was not on the team, even though she was jocked up like the boys. She might have had operational command on the scene.
Could she have been an SVR case officer?
Maybe, admitted Court. But she didn't come out of an embassy. She had a definite edge to her.
a non-official cover operative of some sort, but one with a lot more direct action training than they normally give Russian NOCs.
Could you identify her from images we have of Russian female SVR operatives?
No, no way. Just saw part of her face for less than a second through NVGs.
Brewer changed course. Okay, enough about the attackers. Tell me about Fan Xiang.